Broadcasted live. Catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.
Thanks so much. As I said to you, I said I couldn't contain myself, and I think everybody could see. I think Anastasia said, I can't read your face. Are you just really happy? I said, yes, because we're speaking to Gugu today. So she is coming through to us. As you remember, everybody, Gugu left here, and there were just snot and trana and tears everywhere when she was leaving. But yes, she keeps checking in, and we keep talking to her, finding out, you know, how things are. Gugu, welcome and hello.
Oh, it is such a delight to speak to you, Ospimelo. I'm so excited. I must tell you, I'm sitting in the middle of the snow in a bus driving through the snow in what is a very cold Minneapolis right now.
Yes. And Gugu, just quickly tell us, how has it been and what have you been up to?
It's been a phenomenal experience so far, Ospimelo. We've been on a whirlwind, really crisscrossing various parts of the country, really immersing ourselves in this fellowship program with the World Press Institute. Now, I'm one of 10 journalists from across the world where, primarily, if you look at the cohort, we really are focused on key themes this year when it comes to the fellowship, largely on artificial intelligence, immersing ourselves into the changing dynamics of the media landscape, whether that be profitability, changing audience dynamics, and even understanding how the skill set of journalism has also evolved over the last few years. But the highlight has certainly got to be the elections that are taking place here in the U.S. We're about 5 days away before everybody makes their ways to the polls for physical voting. And that has formed, I guess, part of the aspects that we've been covering. Mm. I must tell you that we've been catching flights more than feelings as we've been... We started off in Minneapolis, moved to Wisconsin, Iowa, then Washington, D.C., New York, Miami, Arizona, San Francisco, Chicago, and just yesterday made our way back here to Minneapolis to continue with our coverage of the elections before I make my way back home in less than 10 days.
It really must be quite an interesting time to cover the elections in the U.S. because we've had the previous elections with Trump, you know, disputing the figures. There were a lot of fake news, and now you have artificial intelligence, which can also be used to manipulate news. So really, really difficult time to be a credible news provider in the U.S. right now.
And that's really the sentiment that's also been reflected by many of the large media agencies we've been speaking to. We visited the likes of MSNBC, Economist, Washington Post, New York Times, BNN, and all of them have been raising the alarm bells around misinformation and disinformation and how artificial intelligence tools are essentially being sought to not only assist in the production of news, the delivery of news, but also measuring how news is actually consumed. Mm. Now, granted, artificial intelligence and many other themes are very new within many newsrooms, and they're still looking at clear ways as to how to adopt some of these technologies, but it is quite clear that they are trying to manage the level of fake news and deepfake information and videos and content that is typically shared with large audiences. So fact-checking has become a major area of focus when it comes to editorial teams, understanding how we need to continue to have, firewalls between commercial interests of media entities together with the editorial positioning, but also making sure that we as journalists and media representatives also, you know, actively participate in shaping the kind of artificial intelligence we choose to use, but also understanding how to regulate and moderate it to avoid any potential abuse going forward.
In a race this tight, Gugu, it must be also difficult to be fair. So when you report on the news, to be balanced. Now, I know that's not necessarily the culture in US, but oftentimes in the US, it's not the culture in South Africa, but oftentimes in the US, you have publications that actually decide that we are Democrats or we are Republicans, and so we are going to be quite openly, unashamedly going to be rooting for a particular candidate. And how has that shaped your understanding of how news is covered fairly in that sense?
I must tell you, it's actually been much of a whirlwind, if I do tell you, in terms of that perception and experience. As you correctly say, South Africa is very different. And what we have seen is that some U.S. publications typically endorse a particular candidate, which is a culture which is very normal within the U.S. A few publications have refrained from offering their opinion as well as their feedback, and largely because that does actually shape the outcomes in terms of, reader perception or audience perception of who it is that they should be voting for. And largely, that's where the electoral outcome. So it is something that has been, I guess, very nuanced,
yes,
and different for me as a South African to actually adapt to.
Yeah.
But what we are finding is that within this particular tight race, everyone is paying very careful and special and specific attention to the candidates that might be endorsed or supported by specific publications, because it does give a much clearer observation as to, you know, where the power might lie, where favoritism might lie, and even the stance and the skewed view on media publications and how they publish reviews.
We often defend the fact that the newsrooms are independent, so to speak. And I'm curious what kinds of conversations you're having when you go to the different publications about, you know, the allegations and the accusations that, no, they are told how to report on stories and so on, because it may not necessarily be true, but the pressure still remains and the accusations still come through.
Oh, 100%. And I must tell you, when we were in New York, I found that because we were covering and speaking to much more the bigger news agencies, think New York Times, Washington Post as well, in DC, MSNBC and CNN, these are companies that are really run by, you know, billions and billions of US dollars. And they've highlighted that, you know, in some instances, it's well declared that they do have a particular view and a stance towards favoring a particular party. CNN is known to be very liberal versus the likes of Fox News, which are regarded as being more conservative and actually in support of the Republicans. And whilst there are various indicators to try and draw lines of independence, what many journalists on the ground have shared, and perhaps in more confidential or off-the-record conversations, is that it has been a tough line to draw, despite the fact that management, editorial teams themselves, as well as leaders of the institutions, do try to maintain a level of independence. But one thing's for certain, I found that it's actually a growing and contentious issue of potential conflict that takes place between the editorial teams together with the commercial teams of the media companies, in terms of trying to establish that independence. But the beauty, I guess, of the U.S. and it being so vast and so wide is that given its size, given the number of media outlets that are available, especially those that pay more attention to a local focus on states and cities that they're in, there is this variety of news which does allow one to actually have a 360 engagement with the one story, but understanding the different ways and angles and perspectives that might be shared within the reporting. So it really does empower audiences to take more independent decisions by evaluating the different opinions that might exist on one particular story.
So what should South Africans really get to understand about these elections? There has been so much movement. You know, I was just saying earlier, I can't call it. I really cannot call it. And I wonder whether on the ground it feels more different. Does it feel, you know, what's the mood like? And it's a difficult question because from one state to another, it must be so different too.
I'm so glad you highlight that, Pamela. I must tell you, coming in at the beginning of September, I actually was very confident that the Democrats would win this, that Kamala Harris has all the support that is required in order to see a clean sweep in terms of these elections. But given our ongoing engagements and my engagements and participations and even debates that we've had, not only with local Americans, but fellows as well from various other countries, we've all walked away with a very different perception of the reality on the ground. What we have noticed is that Democratic supporters tend to be very vocal, very vibrant and very outspoken and honest about their support for Democratic policies. Republican supporters, though, might favor Republican policies and not necessarily like the personality dynamics that surround Donald Trump. So they might not be as open about sharing their opinion or even their support for the Republican Party, but there is an underlying theme of more Republican supporters on the ground versus what we've seen in terms of our interactions with the Democrats. I must tell you that even goes beyond racial lines, which caught me by surprise, given that Donald Trump and the Republican Party have been known to, I guess, share a fear-mongering rhetoric around immigration, specifically when it comes to immigration of individuals from Central America and Mexico specifically. There are a lot of Central Americans or Hispanic people or people of Hispanic origin who actually have voiced their support for Donald Trump.
Black
men in particular have also been very critical of Kamala Harris and even the Democrats overall, saying they've been voting consistently for the Democrats. They've seen no alleviation of the challenges that the black lower class and middle class continues to face, and that there's a significant level of segregation between economic power and social economic standing. And that has, I guess, been the surprise factor where those who are undecided have essentially said that neither of the candidates are very favorable and they wouldn't go for either of them. And some actually opting for what they regard as a write-in, where they would walk into the voting station and actually write in an independent candidate's name, essentially throwing their vote away. So it's not that easy to call. Yeah, in as much as we see the polls change day to day, that's honestly the interactions we've had on the ground as well. So quite frankly, I guess we should prepare for either outcome of the election. One thing is clear, though, is that whoever is going to win this election, it's going to be a very, very thin margin.
I'm getting the sense, Gugu, that the media, both locally within the US and externally, internationally, have not given enough time and effort in reporting on the things that really matter for voters. So there has been a lot of attention on the candidates and what they are saying. But from my understanding, things like the economy, you know, things are really tough. Yes. Inflation is really, really a difficult issue to talk about in the US. People are really going through a difficult time financially. And in essence, it probably is going to be the thing that's going to make them decide who to vote for, rather than all the funfair and the fireworks that we're seeing that makes the bigger headlines.
Mm-hmm. 100%. Ospimelo, it's as though you've been a fly on the wall in many conversations I've had. And that's one of the key themes. So the top three themes, certainly for this year's election, do have to be abortion, immigration, and the state of the economy. The state of the economy is, again, another aspect that caught me by surprise, because if we look at all the metrics around the US economy, the numbers have been showing that it's been very resilient.
Yeah.
There were expectations about a year ago that the US would slip into a recession, there'd be a global crisis, they wouldn't be able to manage their debt. And lo and behold, they've avoided all of those particular challenges. Instead, what we are seeing is that inflation is dissipating, interest rates are coming down, but that's not the lived experience of an average American on the ground. Mm-hmm. Some of the key aspects they highlight is that just the cost of living is exorbitant and way too high. Mm. We travel to cities like Miami and San Francisco, where there's a new theme and a concept which essentially is used to describe unhoused people. Mm. Even the use of that term is essentially caused because they're not trying to describe a particular population as being homeless, because that hasn't been their reality for all their lives, but that these are individuals who at some point were homeowners and property owners, and due to the challenges they faced within the economy, actually lost their homes as a consequence, and now are living in tents on the side of the roads, or even in their cars in particular communities, and go and visit homeless shelters on the odd occasion to actually solicit some kind of support. So that is really the bread and butter issue for many Americans who have become so what they describe as unhoused. And even for younger working professionals, they describe it as a very expensive task to try to access credit in order to afford purchasing a property. So you do find that there's a cross-pollination of generations within households, and baby boomers perhaps supporting millennials and Gen Zs in still staying in their homes and finding it very difficult to actually rent, acquire, or purchase any property within their personal capacity. So that's just on the property side. We haven't even touched pension funds, income stability, and individuals and average Americans working more than one job just to get by.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the reality for many Americans, right? 2-3 jobs at a time, because otherwise they just will not be able to make it.
100%. And that's also quite a telling reality. I must tell you, something else that caught me off guard during this tour is the fact that you have much more senior members of the population who are still employed. Mm. And this is right across the spectrum, whether it be, you know, informal management and positions, or even just as blue collar workers, as they describe them. You would find that the average age of someone who is employed in America ranges between 45 to 55. And that really surprised me significantly, because it's quite telling in terms of the need for Americans to stay employed for as long as possible, because more senior citizens in their 60s, in their 70s, find it very difficult to live off their pension savings, if they even have the benefit of a 401k at all. And that also speaks to the change in legislature, where many employers are no longer obliged to offer benefits to American employees to actually offer them a pension fund. So in many cases, individuals are just employed on a contract basis and do need to find that they put into place the necessary cover that they need for healthcare, for insurance, life insurance, and of course, even their pension savings. So the economic challenges are a lot more visible than what has been described in general news.
So, Gugu, it's 27 minutes after 8. You know we've missed the spot break, so you will understand that I have to take a quick break. I have to take a quick break, and I'll be back with you to continue this fantastic conversation. And listen, if you want to say hello to Gugu, please do that, 086-00-00-959. Gugu, I'll be back with you in a second. Gugu Mfuphi is with us. She's coming through to us from the US, as you know. We've been eagerly waiting to catch up with her since she left, and really fascinating insights that she's just given us about the US elections, her trips to some of the biggest media houses in the US, and how they're covering these elections. So, Gugu, you know, we at the beginning of this campaign trail, we were all watching how the happenings in the Middle East were going to affect the different candidates. I suppose, and I bet you on the ground, that's not the case right now. Nobody's talking about US politics outside of the US.
And that's the interesting part that you mentioned. I do recall, I mean, when October 7th happened and we saw the attacks taking place between Israel and Iran and Lebanon, I beg your pardon, we were actually at the U.S. Senate of State, and it actually brought about, excuse me, the U.S. State Department.
Yes.
It's quite a while ago. There's a lot that's been happening. And this brought about a lot of complexities when we engage with some of the representatives to ask, hold on, is the U.S. paying attention to what's happening across the rest of the world? Mm-hmm. But also, are Americans paying attention to these political dynamics and how these elections will play an influence in those particular outcomes? And it's been interesting messaging that we get depending on who it is that you speak to. Mm-hmm. One thing's for certain is that when it comes to this particular election, Ospimelo, Americans are very focused on what it means for them,
yep,
what it means for their families, what it means for their diplomatic, their domestic affairs, and the vibrancy of the U.S. economy. Many have actually said they want a sense of security. I find it interesting that for an economy that is built on the backs of immigrants, mm-hmm, that they believe that immigration is one of the key aspects that they need to fight against, mm-hmm, right now. But of course, it's the nuance stance around that immigration, that if you're perhaps coming from a nation like Europe or Australia or many other Western nations, that you'll be easily accepted within this market versus those who might be coming from South America and Central America and even aspects of the African continent. So there's some concerns there about how this has been communicated in terms of the management of immigration in the country. One other aspect, though, when it comes to geopolitics, is also how it's separated the level of support that the Democrats have received. We've spoken to a number of Islamic supporters who have highlighted some of concerns around the lack of support that Joe Biden and his administration have actually provided to making sure that there's a ceasefire in the Middle East. We have a participant from Ukraine as well who has often mentioned the full-scale invasion of Russia in the Ukraine and how it is that the U.S. Is actually able to assist Ukraine with this particular crisis and war, but hasn't fully capitalized on the opportunity to step in and intervene in this particular matter. So I think that there's a sense of naivety, or perhaps ignorance might be a stronger word.
They're very
but a
insular.
Sense of Americans saying, hold on, we're not concerned with the rest of the world's issues right now. Russia and Ukraine can be set aside. The Middle East is not too much of a concern. Let's focus on what Americans need and what Americans want. And that has already created a very difficult environment in terms of foreign affairs and international relations, where the rest of the world is saying, hold on, the U.S. as a global power has so much influence. American citizens and policymakers and business owners do need to take a lot more of a open view and keep an open mind in terms of understanding the consequence of their voter outcome.
I must say, I was saying earlier, I'm a little bit concerned about the acceptance of the election results. We've seen what happened the last time. Is there a concern? Is there a concern that not everybody will accept the results?
100%. I guess it also depends on who wins. But you're right, regardless of the election outcome, because things are really that tight, Ospimelo, and we see the polls moving in either direction on any given day, there is a concern that perhaps the election result won't be as easily accepted. And when we say that, I guess there have been calls and suggestions that have been made around potential court challenges that might take place. But I guess nothing as extreme as what we saw with the January 6th attempts and uprising, as we saw on the U.S. Congress. Security measures have been put in place to try to avoid any of those concerns. But it will be quite a contentious issue, regardless of which particular political party might win. I do believe that there will be significant challenges nonetheless.
Gugu, it's so wonderful talking to you. All the best to you. And we cannot wait to see you back. Enjoy the snow, enjoy the freezing cold, because it's pretty warm out here. But lovely hearing from you. And thank you so much for updating us on everything down there.
Thank you. It is so lovely to touch base with the Kaya family. I must tell you, I'm in the middle of the snow. I'm still sitting in the van whilst everybody has gone out to our next meeting. But my Kaya jacket is keeping me very warm. I think you'll be very, very familiar with it. And it's warm. So we'll share pictures of that on social media too.
Lovely, Gugu. All the best to Gugu Mfuphi, who is coming to us live from the US. You know, I think it's just so wonderful, because sometimes we try and get a sense of what's happening on the ground, and it doesn't always come through as being authentic. In fact, Leroy is sitting across from me. Thanks, Gugu. Leroy is sitting across from me, and he's been nodding and, ooh, you know, shaking his head quite a bit. Interesting stuff coming through from Gugu.
Very much. I'm very interested in the polling in the swing states, especially states like Pennsylvania, when you start looking at the women vote. Mm. Because if you look at what happened with the MAGA rally this past weekend,
oh, my goodness,
it really was a bro fest. And it seems that you know, former President Donald Trump doesn't seem to care about the female vote. And that's why Kamala Harris is polling with the female vote around 15% more. Mm. And when you start looking at Pennsylvania, where Joe Biden...
Let me tell you what my concern is about that particular constituency. I have a feeling people are fatigued. I have a feeling there is a cohort of Americans that's just had it.
Yeah.
And that particular, the women that you're speaking of, I think have just had enough.
Yeah.
The noise, the tone has been exhausting.
Yeah.
And also it's been exhausting and hurtful.
Yeah.
In many ways. Mm. And the concern I have is I'm not sure Kamala can count on those people, because I can only imagine, and this happens to all of us around the world. Mm. There is the elections and national interest, and then there's you.
Yeah.
And your daily life. Mm-hmm. And your own daily struggles. And we do not speak enough about people who just check out. Mm. Who check out of the system, because for them, fundamentally, nothing about the election outcomes is going to change their lives.
Yes.
And as a result, they actually don't give a stuff. Kamala, Trump, go at each other, do whatever you want to do. In the end, at the end of the day, how's that going to affect my life? Mm. I will be here tomorrow. I'll be broke tomorrow. I will still have to carry on with the difficulties that I have. And I think we don't talk enough about those people who, yeah, maybe may like the fact that, you know, Kamala is a woman and, you know, she gets them, but may not care enough to leave their houses to go and vote on the day. Mm. And that's where I think there will be a big shift.
I think there's an interesting point to be made about the woman vote, in particular because of what the comments that, you know, the former president did around the Puerto Rican women. And if you look at the swing state, and I use the term very deliberately, of Pennsylvania, where Joe Biden won the state against Donald Trump with 80,000 votes. Okay, there are 500,000 Puerto Rican women in that voting cohort. So that is a really a game changer. But I was watching The View earlier on today, looking at how they were looking at that whole narrative around the people who have checked out. And the issue about, and this is why The Washington Post is going through so much right now, where people have you know, unsubscribed, and three or four of their biggest journalists have been kicked out or quit. Mm. Because when we talk about lies and we're not sure where the lies are coming from, the big rhetoric on the ground, especially from the people who you say have just got too much information and been bombarded with this information, are, I don't know what to believe. Mm-hmm. And in the absence of knowing what to believe, I'd rather believe nothing. I'd rather believe everyone is bad and then I insulate myself. And I think what Kamala tried to do with that was to say, I'm everyone's president, whether you voted for me or not. I'm everyone's president. And I think that's where she missed it. She missed the conversation to say, yes, here's what the truth is and here's what the lies are. Mm. Because remember, you know, former President Donald Trump, he's used to this. He's used to going and using all these expletives.
I was going to say that one of the things we don't also credit him for, you don't have to like Donald Trump.
Yes.
But he's a showman. He's a superstar.
Mm-hmm.
He has done reality TV. He knows how to be a big presence. Mm. He can rile up people. He can make... It doesn't have to make sense.
Mm.
But he sure can get a crowd going. And there is something about him. In all the antics, it doesn't have to be something you like.
Mm.
But there is some quality about him that is superstar material, good or bad.
Yeah.
Kamala is too vanilla.
Yeah.
Too vanilla. There, you know, Hillary Clinton even had some...
Yeah.
Something there. There was something... Yeah, there was something quite... hardish about her. She could hold her own.
Mm-hmm. And know? She had a confidence about her.
She could hold her own amongst the men. There were one or two email scandals, but that was not the point. The point is that this was someone who you would confidently allow her to lead.
Yeah.
To lead a nation, especially internationally.
Mm-hmm.
She was a leader. Kamala is inheriting a democratic country as a democratic party that has not actually delivered
nothing
for the voters, for the democratic vote specifically. So yes, everybody expects the president and the presidency to do stuff for them, but I think Democrats are disappointed.
I think because when you look at the caliber of nominees that they had as the Democratic Party, Kamala was the best they had. And remember that she came in quite late in the game because Joe became incapacitated. So, I mean, literally, he
Is he still talking?
Well, I mean, he put his foot
in it. Why is anybody allowing... You know what they should be doing right now? They should be asking him to help us pack your bags.
Yes.
Because you are leaving the White House. Whether the Democrats win or not, Oksalai, he is leaving. Somebody must take him home to the White House. Let's start packing, Baba.
One of the reviewers this morning said it so well. They said that Joe should not be coming in and speaking on behalf of the Democratic Party.
No. He must just not talk at all. I think right now he needs to pack his bags. They need to preoccupy him. They need to start giving him other little things to do, right? He must have other toys to play
but
with.
But we must
right
draw
now.
The parallel between that je ne sais quoi, that superstardom that you speak about that Donald Trump has, that is the same superstardom that our former president Jacob Zuma has.
Yes, absolutely.
There's a magnetism that we can't explain once people meet him. And what Jacob Zuma does very well, in the same way that Donald Trump does well, is that he speaks to the masses in the language they used to. I sometimes think that Kamala speaks like Thabo Mbeki, too highbrow, too presidential, too many big words. And sometimes when you want a president, you want someone who's able to look and sound like me.
President Mbeki will kill you if he thought for 1 minute he's got as little charisma as Kamala.
I think
he would regard himself as having a little bit more charisma than that.
But remember, this is what happened in Polokwane 2.0, right? That was what was the swinging vote, that he was able, Jacob Zuma, to rally the troops around him because he is a charismatic person. Mm. I'm by no means saying, you know, former President Thabo Mbeki is not charismatic, but what I'm trying to say is that I see what you mean about the hardness of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
But I also think because Kamala comes with the intersectionality of her prejudices, right? She's a woman of color.
Mm.
So she doesn't have the whiteness to protect her in the same way that Hillary does.
Here's where she's falling flat. And we're going on now, but here's where she's falling flat in that regard.
Yes.
Her biggest problem is not having, to your point about being so vanilla, is not having owned her blackness.
Yes.
And for me, that actually has been her weakness. This, I am here for everyone. I am everyone. No, you are not.
Mm.
You are not everyone. Mm. You are this. And that's exactly what I think the black vote has been saying. Well, yes, we like you, but you know, come out clear.
Yeah.
Call it. Be who you are. And don't be apologetic about it. And I think her problem has been, over time, the identity issue has been a little bit dicey.
Yeah.
She has said things that were not quite definitive about who she is, and I think it's going to come back to bite her.
I think she also finds herself sandwiched between two white men, and she's one wanting to be quite establishment because she is part of the current administration. But she's also trying to charter a course where she's, you know, coming out as a woman of her own differences and her own thoughts as a presidential candidate. And I think that's where it's weird, right? You can't, as much as you go buy shoes wearing a pair of shoes, you almost need her to define what her story is. For me, I think the issue in the Middle East is going to always come back to haunt her. I think the relationship between the US and Benjamin Netanyahu is always going to haunt her. I think the issues around the greater Middle East with Yemen, Syria, etc., is always going to haunt her because she still has to speak to the policies of the former of the current president, and people are saying, but that's currently Nsebenzang and Nzanga what we want you to do. So what do? Do we just carry you over and hope that you change it? You're not going to change it. And let me tell you, in the face when you know something doesn't work, you're willing to take something you don't know, hoping it will work. And I think that's what's happening with Donald. He's coming back and saying, I can fix it. Because we've heard this before. And I was listening to Vice President nominee Mang Mang Vance. Papa Uli. He goes there and makes it seem, he elevates the conversation in the room with that Donald. And for me, I'm enjoying watching it. And when Google was talking about the fact that, you know, even the big media houses are trying very hard to almost put to the ground what we're expecting, the acceptance of the national election, Donald this week already tweeted. He's already setting up, January 6th 2.0.
That's exactly what makes me nervous. That's exactly what makes me nervous. What I'm nervous about is that actually it doesn't matter who wins. I think they're going to cause trouble.
Yeah.
I think his supporters are not going to accept the election. So in other words, they better win.
Yeah.
And if they don't, I'm not sure it's going to be smooth. I worry about the fact that particularly with us, and this was something I was supposed to bring up with Gugu, the gold price is going to be affecting us.
Yes.
Because we are a gold producer. Mm-hmm. And I think the instability in the US 3 weeks after the elections, it's going to affect the world. I think there will be, and we don't speak enough about the fact that, you know, how worried we are about the instability and how worried we are about the fair and freeness of the elections in the US.
Yes.
Because US are supposed to be, you know, alpha
beacon
democratic.
Of democracy. Mm.
But there's history and it's very recent.
I really believe that South Africa and the BRICS nations, I think there's something almost serendipitous about the fact that we just had the conference now in Russia, because I also think that the world is of the view that there's a massive instability and PR of brand USA has really tanked, thanks to Donald Trump. And I think most nations are starting to look at an alternative, the de-dollarization of the world economy, the fact that we are all looking to find a new world order, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's where we're trying to see people who are trying to themselves move themselves away from the instability there. Because for me, apart from the college system of election being completely arbitrary in my view, I also just find that we're always beholden to America, who America themselves doesn't do well. We constantly, the gun laws in America don't work. That's always been said, but they keep them every year. We know that Roe versus Wade, termination, be able to terminate and pregnancies and look after your own bodily integrity as a woman. How are we in 2024 reversing those kind of advances?
There was a brilliant article today by a scholar in the US who was calling out how everybody is rejecting the notion that this is not America. So to your point about the fact that how in 2024 in democratic the US, we're reversing the gains and how we are not a beacon of all of this and that. And she says, no. And people calling it, you know, very much similar to Nazi Germany and whatever. Mm-hmm. And she says, absolutely not. This is very much
American.
This is who we are. We are regressive. We are not progressive. And the so-called democracy that we have has not done well for us as African Americans in the U.S. And we need to call it. We need to call it what it is and stop glossing over the real lives that, you know, people are experiencing on a daily basis that are difficult, it's racist, and all of these things that we now call ourselves this wonderful America. But when we really know that America for us as black people is
not
great.
Work. Doesn't
it's not
work.
Great. And it has been for centuries.
And that's why I say the PR of brand USA has been fantastic. And I think the first time we saw the cracks was during COVID, when General J. Trump himself was starting to act a mess. He was going against all the world policy of vaccination and. And I think we've continually been reminded that actually, that's not a great country to live. That's not great. What they're doing right now is not great. And I think even with Sleepy Joe at the wheel, we're now seeing that there's a whole lot that we have to discuss. I was watching The View again this morning, and for me it was so amazing to hear how they were almost pleading for sense to prevail, but like not even the it was just like base, like Batong, the wall, the sky is blue, please believe me, Democrats, look outside the window.
Democrats need to plead for one thing and one thing only between now and Wednesday. They need to plead for people to come out and vote.
Absolutely.
Because if people check out too early and do not come out and vote, I can tell you now, they will be pleading for more.
Yeah, I'm worried about the January 6 2.0, and I hope I'm terribly, terribly wrong.
And I can almost deal with that in a way, if they even step out to vote.
Yes.
So Democrats need to just go out
and vote.
And then we'll deal with the rest later. Let's take a quick break.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.